In the next two episodes of the Discover the Word podcast, Daniel Ryan Day leads the group in a study that may challenge a stereotype you likely have of a group of people that are an important part of the New Testament.
So when I say Pharisees, what comes to mind? What do you think of?
Rules. Mm-hmm. Lots of rules and outward behavior.
And perfection. And presenting perfection at all times. And judgment.
Legalistic.
The bad guys.
Yeah.
The bad guys.
There's even a dictionary entry that if you look up the word Pharisee in the dictionary, comes up a self-righteous person and a hypocrite.
Whoa.
So there's a stereotype for us.
No kidding.
But what's interesting is when we look at the story of the New Testament in particular, there's a few spots where I think some Pharisees play a positive role in the story. And so I thought it would be fun over these next couple weeks to explore some of those examples of places where maybe the stereotype is helpful at times, but where it's also wrong.
Yeah, and so pull your chair up to the table and we'll get started on this two-part study called The Pharisees here on Discover the Word. And like Daniel said, our stereotypical view of the Pharisees may be right at times. Stereotypes usually are stereotypes for a reason. But are stereotypes always accurate? And is it important to remember that there are exceptions where stereotypes break down? Well, the group will have a really good conversation about stereotypes to begin this study that I think will be crucial to the study of the Pharisees. You're listening to Discover the Word, the small group style Bible engagement effort of Our Daily Bread Ministries. Now, Daniel Ryan Day is leading this time around, and with him at the table are Elisa Morgan and Rasul Berry, and a new member of the regular team that you'll be studying with. Vivian Mabuni will be joining Daniel and Elisa and Rasul and Bill Crowder and Mark DeHaan in forming the base Discover the Word group that will rotate into the spots around the table and invite you to pull your chair up with them. So no one's leaving. No one's retiring. We're just expanding the size of the group and then having them share the time that they're part of the discussions. So again, for this study, it's Daniel and Elisa and Rasul and Vivian. Viv has been with Crew for a number of years with their EPIC movement, bringing the gospel to and through Asian American students. She's an author, and speaker, and podcaster, and has been a guest on Discover the Word several times in the last 10 years or so. We've always enjoyed having Vivian with us, and we are now glad that she is able to be a more regular part of our conversations. You'll hear her a few times over the next few months, and then on a more regular basis after that. Okay, so this study of the Pharisees and some Pharisees that may challenge the way we think of all Pharisees in a negative light, we'll begin with an important discussion about stereotypes. And so let's listen.
All right, what is a stereotype?
I you would always define it as an overgeneralization.
Yeah, I think that's helpful.
Yeah, that's good. An overgeneralization. Yeah. It diminishes. I mean, it's just like so cartoonish, you know,
right.
And it diminishes the individual.
It seems like the word all, like all people, or it's just, like you said, generalization for sure.
Yeah, so it's usually a widespread, overly simplistic belief of a certain group or people group. And so widespread, meaning lots of people typically think this, and then overly simplistic because it lacks the nuance of how complicated people are and how diverse an individual can be and stuff like that. Are stereotypes positive? Are they negative? Both? What do you think?
I think they can be both or either.
Yeah, I think as I'm thinking about it, there's an element of stereotypes that even when they're quote unquote positive, they have a way of stripping us from our our humanity, our
totally.
Because like, for instance, you know this in any kind of relational communication therapy, you never say, you always leave the door open, right? So you know that that just does something. But even if someone flips it on the other side and they say, you're always the strong one. And you think to yourself, no, I'm not.
Yeah.
You know, like even though it's positive, it still distorts who you really are.
That's a good word. I would say it's negative because of the lack of nuance. Mm-hmm. So even in a positive sense, but mm-hmm. just not being able to see a person individually for who they are, or even a group of people to understand more of the backstory, I think just lends to a greater understanding. So I think stereotypes are too shallow.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Yeah. And I noticed earlier, Vivian, you used the word all. Rasul, a second ago, you used the word always. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be a helpful indicator to us of when we're maybe leaning into a stereotype or looking for those like all-inclusive language that all of a sudden really, as you said, kind of strips people of the nuance. I've heard that any kind of generality, which a stereotype is a generality, that they can be helpful at times, but they're always wrong because of that, because of lacking the nuance. They're too simplistic to describe different people groups. They can be helpful because sometimes maybe they describe values or priorities of a people group that help us maybe understand a little bit of some history there or something like that. But ultimately, they end up being wrong because they can never capture who a person really is. So I want to kind of pick on myself first and describe some of the stereotypes that I've run into, both positive and negative. And feel free to laugh with me at this because you all know me, so it's okay. So I grew up in the country, and people who live out in the country have a stereotype that comes with them. The positive is that we have simple lives and find joy in simple pleasures, like a good old bonfire in the middle of a field, right? But maybe a negative stereotype would be simple-minded or uneducated, okay? I grew up Southern Baptist and very thankful for that foundation for my faith that I was given. And one of the positives that people often say about Southern Baptists is that really evangelistic, sometimes innovative in the way that they do church. But the negative has its own little limerick or saying or whatever. We don't drink, dance, or chew, or go with girls that do. So I kind of want to go around the table and just throw it out. Maybe Rasul, we'll start with you. Like, what are some of the stereotypes that you've experienced, negative, positive?
Yeah, I think growing up inner city Philly, single parent home, African American, when I got to college, there were folks who didn't think that I necessarily earned my spot when I got there, that there was somehow, because of my background, oh, you clearly didn't deserve it. You must have got some help from the admissions office in order to get there. And that was frustrating and difficult because I was second in my class and, you know, I was senior class president. I had the credentials, but it was just the assumption that because of where I was from and what my story was, I, you know, somehow didn't deserve. But on the positive, also dealing with college, going to an Ivy League school, people assume often, oh, you must be smart.
Which I would say,
you don't
Rasul.
Have to laugh that hard.
No, I would say, Rasul, you are brilliant.
But yeah, I think that that can, I know of people that I went to my school that I'm going, that would not be an accurate assumption, you know, and even when it comes to certain topics and things like that, I have a lot to learn. So I think I've seen it on both sides.
Yeah. You use the word assumption, which is interesting, too. I think that ties into stereotypes really well. We assume a lot about certain people. Vivian, what about you? What are some of the stereotypes that you've run into, positive and negative?
Yeah. Interesting you would ask, and kind of dovetailing off of Rasul. I am Asian American, so you can't tell, you know, by listening to my voice necessarily. But when I walk into a room, there are assumptions made. And I think one of the things I'm proud of in being Asian American is that the collective is more important than the individual. So that's kind of hardwired into my DNA and most communities of color, really, this collective over the individual. So I think that's a really positive trait. And I see it lived out in so many different ways, just how we navigate life. A negative stereotype is that a lot of people just assume that I'm really good at math, which is just not true. Like, I can't even balance my checkbook. So so there are, like, you know, stereotypes that are funny, but they also can take away from not really knowing my story. And that's the part that I think is the downside.
Yeah, using the phrase, don't know my story. Right. Or don't know us well. And like, those are all pieces of how stereotypes kind of dehumanize us at times, because we just assume we know about people. And when we learn their story, we find out, oh, I missed some things here. All right, Elisa.
Well,
round this out.
That's a great segue, because I was actually thinking about that. I remember moving from Houston, Texas, to Denver, Colorado, to attend seminary, and I was a single 22-year-old. I mean, I was so young, and the student body was 90% male, 85% married male, and you know, and here I am, and I was in the MDiv program, which was also unusual for a woman, you know, and I remember going into class and people would just look at me like, what are you doing here? Mm. And it was so odd. And the other piece that went with that is that I too grew up in a broken home, Rasul, and in the context, I learned some really helpful ways to cope socially. Like I know how to turn on this outgoing personality and I can be bubbly and blah, blah, blah. Inside, I'm more of an introvert and more of a quiet person. And I've had to kind of balance that for authenticity. So part of it was brought on by me, Daniel, you know, and and I own that. But the other part of it is the assumption of, well, she's from Texas and girls from Texas are like this, or she's a woman in a male place. What's that about? And so I really appreciate that we're scratching beneath the surface to talk about how the assumptions leave the individual unknown and unrecognized and unseen.
Yeah. And the layer I think that you added that's really helpful is the idea that sometimes we can bring that on ourselves a little bit by trying to fit into a spot where maybe we don't naturally fit in the same way. And by doing that, we almost reinforce sometimes the stereotypes that we don't want to. I'm going to expand it a little further. Don't answer these out loud. Okay, let me repeat that. Don't answer these out loud, and you'll see why.
Okay.
I want to talk about some of the other different types of stereotypes that exist. So there's ethnic stereotypes. So just in your mind, think about how you would maybe finish this phrase. Jews are, Mexicans are, Russians are, or cultural stereotypes. New Yorkers are. Californians are, Southerners are, Parisians are, or maybe some religious stereotypes. So Muslims are, Buddhists are, Hindus are, atheists are. Positional stereotypes. All politicians are. That we all had something strong come to mind on that one. All pastors are. Racial stereotypes. Black people are, Asians are, white people are. It's amazing how just putting that phrase out there, we have ideas that come to mind, and it's helpful just to sit with those sometimes. We touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want to kind of really dig in and emphasize this a little bit. What makes stereotypes potentially dangerous or harmful? And we can just repeat some of the things that we've already said.
Well, as we said, we run the risk of being unseen or not seeing others. We look through our own glasses of assumptions, and we miss people.
Yeah, I think about it, how it erases our individuality and being made in the image of God. And even God himself, when you understand the Trinity, realize that there's personalities and, you know, uniquenesses there that people can make stereotypes about God, right? Like that are not completely like,
that's
accurate.
A great point. Yeah.
And so I think that anything that erases our uniqueness goes against that vision that God has for us as being made in his image.
Yeah, and I think dovetailing off of image of God, even as I think when we forget that all people are made in the image of God, I think we can start to favor people that we either know personally or,
that's good.
You know, have some kind of relationship with, but we can forget that all the people that you just listed and these groups of people all were made in the image of God. Even if they don't agree with us, they still have inherent dignity and value.
Yeah, and one of the things that you just pulled out was the way we treat people differently based on whatever group we've placed them in. And sometimes we treat them with favoritism,
right?
Because we see something there, and sometimes it's mistreatment. So the reason we've spent so much time talking about this is because this week we're going to lean into a people group that have been stereotyped. In fact, it's a group that Christians in particular, me being the chief of sinners, have stereotyped in a very negative way. And in fact, rarely do we say anything positive about this group of people. It's led to a history of mistreatment and abuse and even Holocaust in the way that we've spoken about this group of people. It's a stereotype that's pretty pervasive throughout seminaries or colleges or books
churches.
Or leaders, churches. And one of the reasons I'm leading this series is because over the last few months in particular, I've felt very convicted by the way I've perpetuated this stereotype, even on this show. Mm. And so I thought it was important to lean into that and research it a little bit. So when I say Pharisees, what comes to mind? What do you think of?
Rules. Mm-hmm. Lots of rules and outward behavior.
And perfection. And presenting perfection at all times. And judgment.
Legalistic. The bad guys.
Yeah.
The bad guys.
There's even a dictionary entry that if you look up the word Pharisee in the dictionary, comes up a self-righteous person and a hypocrite.
Whoa.
So there's a stereotype for us.
No kidding.
But what's interesting is when we look at the story of the New Testament in particular, there's a few spots where I think some Pharisees play a positive role in the story. And so I thought it would be fun over these next couple weeks to explore some of those examples of places where maybe the stereotype is helpful at times, but where it's also wrong. And so should be fun. Does that sound good?
Sounds great.
I'm excited. Right.
Thanks for digging this out for us.
Let's do it.
Yeah, I think this is going to be a stretching series of conversations in a lot of ways. Because what feeds our negative stereotype of the Pharisees is definitely there in Scripture. I mean, it's tough to get around the fact that many, or at least some, influential Pharisees were interested in finding ways to get rid of Jesus. And by get rid of, I mean kill. But as we're going to see, characterizing, generalizing, stereotyping the entire group would not be always right. There were exceptions, some important exceptions, that you'll recognize and that may help us think of the Pharisees in a more nuanced way. So now let's work at getting more familiar with the cultural and historical context that contributed to this group becoming so influential in the lives of the Jewish people of Jesus' day. As we've said so many times as we've discovered the word together, context is king. Knowing the context is so important. And so let's listen, as in the next couple of segments of the conversation, they identify three key aspects of the context of the world in which they lived that in a startling way correspond with what we face today.
I want us to start by reading what I think is a pretty surprising verse. So this is Matthew 23, verses 1 through 3, and I put an A there. Usually we don't read half verses on Discover the Word, but I think it's important because it sets up the rest of that. So Vivian, would you read that for
us? Sure. It says, "Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, 'The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat, so you must be careful to do everything they tell you.'"
Anyone else find that verse surprising?
Yeah.
What's surprising about it?
Well, we've been talking about how we stereotypically view Pharisees as hypocritical, legalistic, and so to have Jesus say that we must be careful to do everything they tell us is surprising. Now, help us understand, what does it mean to sit in Moses' seat?
Yeah, so it's a sign of respect that Jesus is referencing. It's also recognizing kind of their authority as religious leaders. And specifically, it's like saying, in the line of Moses, who handed down to us the law, and the Pharisees in particular, and we'll see this quite a bit, really held on to both the written law and the oral law passed down through the generations.
And like the legacy of the law.
Yeah, the legacy of the law. And it's kind of a similar thing that when people talk about ordination, they link people who are ordained back to Peter, which depending on what your denomination is how intense that is. But the idea of laying on of hands has happened all the way back to the apostles. And so it's like the church authority or the authority of religious practice and things like that is what is kind of being referenced there.
And I can't help but think that's some of why it is counterintuitive for us to see Jesus highlight and affirm the authority of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees in light of this institutional significance of the continuity of authority. And I think especially because in an American context, I mean, literally our country is birthed out of rebelling against authority. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a even postmodern streak of suspicion. And there's a lot of reason, good reasons, that people have developed some sort of posture of suspicion against authority. But I think that doesn't tell the full story of how humanity best flourishes and thrives if we just completely reject all institutions. But I think that that sentiment, that posture that we have culturally in this moment makes this feel even harder, more strange.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And then to have Jesus be the one to be saying this, I mean, he is the ultimate source. And he's instructing not only the crowds, but his disciples. So the fact that he would underscore this and have it be a teaching holds a lot of weight.
Yeah. And part of the reason I think we miss this phrase in particular is because Jesus then turns and talks about, but don't do what they do. And then we have a whole list of critique, right? Very hard critique. In fact, Matthew 23, more than any other chapter in the New Testament, is the chapter that has caused the most tension between Jews and Christians because of the way Jesus talks about the Pharisees. But I think it's important for us to recognize where this chapter starts.
Okay. That's good.
And it starts with Jesus showing respect. It's not a blanket rejection of the Pharisees or their teachings. And so there's even Jesus has some nuance here that he's drawing on. So I just wanted to throw that out there as we start this conversation. And maybe as we go through, especially these next two conversations, I think we'll see kind of what the historical context is, the cultural context, and maybe that'll help us recognize why the Pharisees lean certain ways and maybe what led to critique later. But I just wanted to start with this idea that Jesus says, be careful to do everything they tell you, which is pretty fascinating. Before we enter the story of the New Testament, it's important to know that the land of Israel has been far from stable in this time period. Going back specifically, really all the way to Babylon, there was a little bit of a quote-unquote quiet period after Babylon until about 330 BC. But from then on until the temple is destroyed after Jesus in 70 AD, it's just a mess. Revolts, different foreign leaders, all those things. So I put a few notes in the outline for you ahead of time. Was there anything in those notes that jumped out to you about the kind of climate of that time?
Seems to me there's such a, that idea of just being conquered, reconquered, conquered again, living under, really, outside forces. So what does it look like to retain faith in Yahweh and being set apart? Just, I mean, obviously familiarity with the Old Testament, but from the very beginning, it was like a people, God's people, to be set apart, different than the nations, the surrounding nations, and then to be living under the rule of Rome or the Assyrians, the Babylonians, all the people. I don't think I read the Bible recognizing how much the people in the Bible were living their environment. I tend to think of it as I'm reading it in my context, like in the United States, and there's freedom of religion. It's very different depending on the ruler.
And part of what makes that hard as well isn't just the religious aspect, but also like, what does it mean to even be Jewish?
Yeah.
Because we're under foreign leaders with foreign cultural influences and things like that. So they're having to rethink what that looks like as well. Yeah.
I am struck by the centuries-long threat and experience of violence. And specifically when I think about the king of Syria conquered Jerusalem in 167 BC and offered and sacrificed a pig on the altar to Zeus in the temple, you know. And obviously this was a statement meant to desecrate their everything that they held true, to break them psychologically, spiritually, but just to have to endure those kind of experiences. And that's just symbolic, not to mention all the violence that happened, that there was just a really intense time of life and death type tension.
And the amount of violence, as Rasul mentioned, there was so much violence. As a result, there was also several revolts that happened, which kind of leads us to two questions that they were asking all the time, which was, are we to follow Judaism regardless of who's in power? Are we supposed to overthrow leaders when they come in? There's a lot in the law about what our leadership should be, and we can't do this in the same way under these leaders. So should we overthrow them to be better Torah followers? So those are all the questions they're kind of asking. And as Christians, we ask kind of a similar thing, not should we overthrow our leaders? Hopefully, we're not asking that question. But should Christians be involved in politics or not? Or is that a different space and we should let that be what it is and Christians should focus on just following Jesus or whatever? So we can kind of relate a little bit to maybe some of that. Let's also look at the cultural context, too. So one of the things that foreign leaders bring with them is culture. And so what was the primary cultural pressure, there's a term, from that time period that they were experiencing?
Hellenism.
Hellenism. Mm-hmm. Fancy word for what?
The rule of Helen.
And if you have a mom named Helen, you know what that means.
So Hellenistic culture is Greek culture, and starting with Alexander the Great and kind of that being perpetuated throughout the world. And
which is different because they had a whole mythology of gods and goddesses. And, you know, so, I mean, we're used to looking at Baal worship and et cetera, you know, in the Old Testament. This is a different kind of god worship, different gods.
And what does culture bring with it? What you eat, what you wear, what you do, who you worship, how you learn, all of those things are tied into culture. And so all of that is being at times pushed on, and at other times they're invited into becoming a different kind of people. And so that's one of the other pressures. So they have the pressure of violence and revolt. They have this pressure of culture. And so one of the questions is, well, what does it mean to be Jewish in a Hellenistic culture? So what does it mean to be Jewish under foreign leaders? And then what does it mean when you have all of these cultural influences around?
You know, it's interesting when I think about that. It's my understanding is that business was conducted in Greek. So that meant that Jewish people had to speak another language in order to conduct business. So that meant that now the Jews living in Jerusalem are going to be multilingual in order to be able to navigate. I just forget those things. But to communicate in a separate language to, you know, conduct business is a...
To live.
Yeah, it's, it is. It's your livelihood. You can't just be sequestered and...
Right. And know. Even beyond the language, there's the cultural norms and worldview. You know, there was a social media phenomenon that was going on asking question, how often do you think of the Roman Empire, specifically talking about men, that, you know, men tend to, I guess, think about the Roman Empire more than women.
But I did not know that.
I think
I thought it was football.
Part of the but part of the idea there is that they had to think about the Greco-Roman Empire all the time because there was this vision. I was just watching My Big Fat Greek Wedding, the second one. And the father's always like making everything Greek, like, you know what I mean? So it's like, give me a word and I'll tell you it's Greek origin. Greek. And even though it's this kind of hilarious kind of gag throughout, it does reveal this kind of pride and this perspective that emanated from the culture that says we are the arbiter of all things, like the height of human civilization. And with that comes exertion of power as well to say that everything else is subject to us. So if you're in that world and in that space, what does it mean to have a totally different understanding of who God is and how we're supposed to live with him when the culture is literally trying to push you into a form of another, like a round peg into a square hole?
We talked about under the political stress and pressure, some of the natural questions are like, well, what does it mean to be Jewish under foreign leaders? In this context, it's like, well, what does it mean to be a Jew culturally in this setting? Is it something that you're born into and that's it? If you're born a Jew, you're a Jew and that's your invitation? Or is Jewishness something you also put on? And so it's the values and the way that you live and those types of things as well. And so as we enter the world of the Pharisees, this is the world that we're entering into. All of these pressures and things that they're facing and they're trying to figure out. And I think as we lean into these different topics throughout the series, I think we'll find a lot of parallels to some of the same pressures and things that we feel as well. How much should we get involved in politics? What if a government seems to promote an agenda we disagree with? How do we respond? How do we follow God in a modern culture and context, especially if we feel like that culture is pushing against how we feel we should live? These are good questions. Mm-hmm. And when we ask these types of questions, what we're doing is asking some of the same questions that the Pharisees did.
Yeah, could the questions that they were thinking about be more similar to the kinds of things we spend a lot of time thinking about today? Not really. Of course, there were huge differences, too. I mean, this was over 2,000 years ago. But what to do and how to think about politics presented issues. The pull of the culture was strong. And so where to resist and where not to resist that pull of the culture, they had questions about that. And I think we're beginning to get a better understanding of the Pharisees and what motivated them. And so in this next segment, Daniel and Elisa and Rasul and Vivian are going to add another layer of context to this discussion. In addition to politics and the culture, the Pharisees had religious issues that they dealt with and tried to untangle. Again, sound like today for us at all?
So we ended our last conversation with some of the questions and concerns that were facing the Jewish people during what's called the Second Temple period. And that's just a fancy term that people use for that time in between when they return from Babylon and build a temple, and then Herod kind of reimagines it and makes it a lot nicer, to when it's destroyed in 70 AD after Jesus' life. So that's called the Second Temple period. But what were the two primary questions and tensions that they were experiencing that we talked about last time?
Well, one, we discovered Hellenism is not about a woman named Helen.
No.
the dominance and the prevalence of Greek culture and the ways in which living in a Jewish community that is having the pressure of a Greek culture overlaid over it creates unique tensions about where you go, about what you do, about, you know, what you wear, right? Mm-hmm. Do I absorb some of the aspects of the culture? What do I do with the money? Like, there's a whole lot of questions that just the reality of Hellenism created for the Jewish experience and really for everybody around the world.
And the other one was really, how do I live under this foreign government and still follow the law? You know, how do I do it? And, you know, that's the age-old question of, am I inclusive and do I immerse myself in my culture, or am I a separatist and do I live separate from my culture? And that's something we face as well today.
Yeah, absolutely. So in this conversation, I want to add one more layer, and I want to teach you a word that I learned in this research, halakha.
It sounds Hawaiian.
Halakha is basically, what does the interpretation of the law or the Torah look like for everyday life? Mm. So the question would be, what does following Torah look like in a world that's different from Moses at this point, different from the Israelite monarchy under David and Solomon, different than the world of the prophets? What does it look like? And it's specifically talking about legal Torah interpretation. So what does it look like to live this out in everyday life? And the answer to that question of how to live it out is one of the things that divided the groups of Jewish people into a couple different groups. There's three we know of for sure. What were those three?
So we had the Pharisees that we talked about, and they, to me, were not the take over the government radical rebel types. But then we have the Sadducees who are different. So Pharisees and Sadducees believing even differently about the Torah and eternal life and things like that. And then the Essenes.
Yep. Those are three of the groups, and we're going to talk about those more in a minute. So these questions about how to interpret the law, how do you live it out in everyday life, that was debated even within Judaism, which is very similar to
how we live today, right, within Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yep, we're trying to figure out, you know, and you've probably joined a denomination based on how they answer that question of what it looks like to live out our faith. So before we lean into how the Pharisees talked through this a little bit, I want to talk about another surprising verse from Jesus as well. This is Matthew chapter 5, verses 17 through 20. So Matthew 5 should ding, ding, ding in our heads.
Sermon on the Mount.
Sermon on the Mount. Okay. Yep. So if someone would read, maybe Elisa, if you could read verses 17 through 20 for us of Matthew 5.
Sure, sure. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've come not to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until it is all accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven.
I find that surprising. What jumps out to you about that passage?
The difference between the way that Jesus would say values and affirms the law mm-hmm. versus how oftentimes in Christian communities, like there's just more of a suspicious or even negative mm-hmm. connotation yeah. with the law. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even the Old Testament. A mm-hmm. lot of Christians are like, oh, the Old Testament, mm-hmm. God is so angry. And just splitting that. But there's such a high value and view of the law. Mm-hmm. Jesus is clearly elevating and giving honor to not only the law, but the people that are trying to stay close to obeying and being set apart in the midst yeah. of this context.
This verse 20, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and the Pharisees, mm-hmm. you'll never enter the kingdom. That feels impossible.
Yeah. Mm.
And I've gotten stuck on that many times, Daniel. So mm-hmm. I'm glad you're bringing it up because I know I can't. I can't equal anybody's righteousness, you know. But I go back to the very first part in verse 17. I have come not to abolish it, but to fulfill. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I think that word fulfill has the connotation to complete it, you know, to make it perfect, to bring it to the fullest source. Mm. And so when we're reading this, it is surprising. But it's so Jesus-y that, you know, he's saying you have to be this way, but I'm fulfilling it. Mm. And I think that's missed on us. And I think it was missed on many of the Pharisees in that time, too, because we have a very difficult time putting those two concepts together. Yeah. Righteousness, which we think is all about us doing it, mm-hmm. and Jesus fulfilling it, because we just separate mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. law and Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And what makes it harder in this passage is he talks about doing and teaching others to do the same, which mm-hmm. is to follow the commandments, to follow the law. And even that word righteousness at this point in the Jesus story is pulling on a thread that they'd be very familiar with, which was the idea that, well, how are you seen as righteous? Mm-hmm. Well, it's through being set apart as mm-hmm. God's people mm-hmm. through keeping Torah and how they're living out Torah mm-hmm. in everyday life. So what do we know about Pharisees from the Second Temple period? Actually, it's interesting. We know very little historically about the Pharisees. I was reading a bunch of scholarly articles and digging deep, trying to find more and more cultural information about the Pharisees. But there's actually only one Pharisee that we have a large collection of his writings. And do you know who that was?
The Apostle Paul.
The Apostle yes. Paul.
Which I keep forgetting yeah. that he was a Pharisee. So it's a good reminder.
That, yep. And that's interesting that a group that would have been so literate would not have left a lot of description of their practices.
Mm. Yeah, and it might be tied to the fact that the temple's destroyed in 70 AD, and so much of that culture and city was destroyed yeah. at that point. Mm. In fact, a lot of the writings we have about the Pharisees are negative because they come from groups that weren't Pharisees. Mm. So in Qumran, yeah. with the Dead Sea Scrolls, there's a lot of things about the Pharisees, but it's almost all critique, mm-hmm. but it's not written by Pharisees. So the only collection we have from a Pharisee, or the largest one, is from Paul, which is surprising. The Pharisees are mentioned almost 100 times in the New Testament, so quite a few times, but there's only a few named Pharisees. Do you know who those are?
We got Paul.
Well, we got Paul.
There we go.
Nicodemus.
Nicodemus, yeah.
He's always the one that yeah. comes to mind.
I don't remember. I get Ananias, the one who helped Paul. Was he?
We don't know.
We don't know.
For sure, but okay. most likely because of his being tied into the temple and priestly. Uh-huh. He's probably a Sadducee, but we don't know for
okay.
sure. So.
Okay.
Paul's teacher.
Yeah.
Yeah, Gamaliel. And maybe Joseph of Arimathea.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
we'll talk
the,
about
the
that when we
helped
get there.
With the grave.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why might it be significant to have named Pharisees in the story? What makes that different than talking about a group of Pharisees? And this kind of ties back to our first conversation.
Right, that's what I was thinking. The stereotypes, now we can actually put a face to it. And it's like, oh, that changes things because now we have someone's story that's tied into this title.
Yeah. So I want to run through just a few more things real quick, and then we'll start talking about some of these names and get to know them a little bit and see how that might shape how we view this group. So the Pharisees are considered a Jewish party or sect. We get this language specifically from the historian Josephus, who's writing for a Roman audience, and he wants to make sense of the Jewish experience for a Roman audience. So he makes these very fine, clear boundaries between the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, or Qumran community. Now, for the Jewish people, their experience of that was different than it wasn't as cut and dry as Josephus tried to create these buckets and act like everybody fit into these buckets. So he's describing them as philosophical schools or like thinking schools, so they think differently about things, and he puts them into these groups. The main difference that we see in some of these groups is, again, going back to the word that we learned at the beginning of this conversation, halakha, so the interpretation and the living out of the law. The Pharisees were kind of the everyday rabbis who were teaching people outside of the temple what it looks like to live out the faith. The Sadducees tended to be the priests. They were the sons of Zadok, who were the priestly line. And then the Essenes were a community that we think mostly left culture and went and set up a community out in the wilderness, kind of like a monk-style community.
Separatist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. None of those are completely fair because there were mixtures of all. There's an Essene community that is attached to a regular city. So it's not as clear as we want it to be, but as we talked about with stereotypes, it never is, right? It's never that clear. And so this is the world of the Pharisees. They're experiencing cultural pressure, political pressure, as we talked about, and this religious layer of what does it look like to live out the faith in everyday life.
I think about the need to figure out how to be faithful to God and how similar that is to the same kinds of conversations that we might have today.
Yep.
For instance, we think about Chariots of Fire and Eric Little, who famously sensed the conviction not to compete in the Olympics because it was held on a Sunday. You know, well, now think of all the sporting events that are held on Sundays. And we can simultaneously see the honor and what he did, but then also see the practicality that because of where our culture is today, we might have to make different types of stances in order to still remain faithful, or at least we have to think about it differently. The cost is
exactly That is very Pharisee-like, Rasul, what you just described. So in the past, they could do it this way. Right. Now things seem different, so do we still do it that way, or should we think about it?
And it seems like the Sadducees was like, hey, just go with the flow. Like, you know, their approach was more, and I think it's significant that they come from the priestly line because their high priority is maintaining this, you know, this line. So whatever kind of accommodation we need to make, we'll do it. Whereas the Pharisees' impulse is more about this internal distinction that's less about the genetic kind of lineage and more about the spiritual. But we can see those same types of impulses in us.
Yeah. My understanding was the Pharisees were trying to build a fence around the Torah. So they ended up with these oral traditions that we'll be talking about. But there is such a desire to protect the truth and to be different than everyone around them. So I just have a greater appreciation for the heart behind what was driving this, you know, and again, the hypocrisy is a real thing. We deal with that in Christendom right now. I mean, that's probably the biggest reason why the youth are leaving the church is because of hypocrisy.
Yeah. And that's, to me, the heart behind it is what jumps out to me as well as we get to know them. They're very much working toward how do we live out this true faith in the midst of this culture that feels very different, feels very difficult in order to live out this faith. And that's a question, like we all said, that we can all relate to. And I think we'll see as we begin to explore actual Pharisees with names, how they're kind of asking and struggling through the pressures of Hellenism, of politics, and of religious questions that they had.
And I think that's been a helpful way over the last couple parts of this conversation of helping us understand the context in which the Pharisees operated. Understanding the political and cultural and religious aspects of what shaped them really is crucial to understanding what is an important group of people and how the story of Jesus is told in the Gospels. And I think that should give a good foundation for us to build on as we move forward in these conversations that will maybe nuance the stereotypical way in which we think about the Pharisees. There are several Pharisees, the New Testament names, that will not fit the 100% negative opinion we often have of them. And so in just a moment, the Discover the Word team turns to John chapter 3 and introduces us to the first actual Pharisee that we're going to meet in this series. During his time, he was very well known. He was a well-respected member of this group, but seemed to be open to what he was seeing and hearing about Jesus in a way that not everyone was. And so find out who we're talking about and his famous encounter with Jesus, where he challenges the stereotype of the typical Pharisee. We'll do that after a short break. Now, Discover the Word is just one of the Bible engagement efforts of Our Daily Bread Ministries. Another is our publishing arm that publishes books that will help you grow and deepen your relationship with the Lord. And we have a number of books that I think would dovetail nicely into this study we're doing. One especially that I'd like to recommend is a newly released book called Encounters with Jesus. Now, Encounters with Jesus was written by our co-worker here at Our Daily Bread Ministries, J.R. Hudberg. He's the executive editor of the Discovery Series of Bible study material that I've mentioned to you before. And in the book J.R. wrote, he probes Jesus' interactions with a variety of people from his day, believers, skeptics, scoffers, the passionate, and the immovable. And in 40 short chapters or scenes, he allows us to see through them our needs and our concerns, and then also confront us with some of the same choices Jesus gave those that he met back then. It really is a thought-provoking book, and I would recommend it to you. So just go to the Our Daily Bread Publishing website at ourdailybreadpublishing.org and search for Encounters with Jesus. That's ourdailybreadpublishing.org. Search Encounters with Jesus. And so now, let's see what we can discover about a Pharisee named Nicodemus.
Would someone read John 3, verse 1 for me? Rasul, maybe you could grab that?
Sure. Now there was a Pharisee named Nicodemus, a leader of the Jews.
All right, so what is his role exactly?
Pharisee and leader.
Leader, yeah. So we don't really have much more than that.
Exactly. Well, he'd probably be a rabbi, wouldn't he?
Yeah, probably a rabbi, especially we get the impression that he seems like an older Pharisee as a leader.
Mature.
Elder kind of person, so probably a rabbi, yep. We meet this guy in John 3, and we have almost no context for who he is, or even John, as he's writing, didn't feel like he needed to give us a little heads up of, and by leader, I mean, da-da-da-da-da.
Right.
Which maybe that means that at this point, the audience that received this gospel knew a lot about Nicodemus, and so they're like, oh yeah, that guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how influential were the Pharisees of Jesus' time? So when Nicodemus was
We think pretty influential. I mean, the general heart of a Pharisee was to protect the truth and to preserve it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it just, I want to put this on the table. It reminds me a lot of our leaders within our world of Christianity and those who really do want to protect the truth. Mm-hmm. And yet we can get kind of controlling and authoritative and end up detracting rather than attracting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that just walking down the street, I think the typical Jewish person would revere and honor a Pharisee, that they would see them as, okay, these are the people that are really living out what we believe. So collectively, we observe the Sabbath and we don't eat these certain foods, but these guys, they're the real deal. Like, they're the ones helping us to learn how to do this walking with God. In the same way, what Lisa, what you're saying, I think we look at Christian leaders in the same way. Like, there's, it's almost like that celebrity Christian thing that we don't want, but is still part of our makeup. And I think that the Pharisees were kind of like that. Like people would see them, recognize them, give them the seats of honor.
And there's a lot of evidence that the group of Pharisees also included a lot of small town farmers and people like that that were a part of the group of the Pharisees.
And, lay people, kind of.
A lot of lay people. They were so influential that there is some evidence that Sadducees, when they had disagreements with the Pharisees, would still go along with what the Pharisees thought because they were influential enough during Jesus' time. And there was a bigger group than just the group that we see in the Bible. And that's important to realize too. So anytime we use a phrase that sounds like all Pharisees or the Pharisees always, we're putting them into a narrow group when in reality we only have a very small picture of who they are. There was a lot more of them than we see even in the New Testament story. And the biggest question that they were asking was, what does it look like to live out this faith in everyday life with all these pressures that they're experiencing? So Nicodemus, a Pharisee, a leader of the Jews, what does he do in this story?
He comes to Jesus.
When?
At night.
Yep.
And wants to ask him some tough questions.
Yeah. And we had Randy Richards on here before. What did Randy Richards say could be going on with the fact that he comes at night?
Yeah, that Nicodemus was actually honoring Jesus in a shame honor culture where to ask him questions like that in public and in day would be a real test and like trying to make Jesus fail, you know, trying to expose Jesus. But to come at night would be to honor Jesus and out of great sincerity.
Which is the exact opposite of what I've heard was happening in this when I first, you know, heard sermons and things, that it was more about him testing Jesus. And maybe that there was a sense of embarrassment or hiding from people that caused him to come in under the cover of darkness. So that's just kind of an interesting kind of framework, because when I think about the other instances of Pharisees asking Jesus questions in the daytime, it is always in a very confrontational or at least most of the time. You're making me think about the
always. Right.
There we go. Wait a minute. It is often in a confrontational way.
Yeah. And so that's one thing. He could be honoring Jesus, wanting to enter into a dialogue instead of a debate. Throughout the Gospel of John, there's also a play on light and darkness.
Right.
So Jesus is the light of the world. And Nicodemus comes at night. And so there could be some aspect in which Nicodemus, as we see in this story, is kind of struggling to understand what Jesus is saying, which I think when we look at these things, we might be like, oh, that is tough. I don't know if, I think I would have been with Nicodemus and struggling as well.
Yeah.
But the fact that he comes at night could be kind of metaphorically representing Nicodemus's confusion and his questions. What does Nicodemus say to Jesus?
He says, "We know you're a teacher who's come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do apart from the presence of God."
And what does he call him first?
Rabbi.
Rabbi. Yeah, so the term rabbi, what's kind of that about?
Teacher.
Yeah, so teacher.
Still to this day uses.
Yeah, and the Pharisees are the forerunners of the rabbinic movement, which is what Judaism basically is today in many ways. And so the idea of calling him rabbi is calling him like, you're one of us. Like, I recognize that. You're one of us as a teacher. They're not priests, meaning not Sadducees in the temple. This is a different kind of Jewish teacher or leader. And so there's a sign of respect there. And also maybe a recognition that maybe Jesus is also trying to help people think about what it looks like to live out Torah in everyday life, which is a very Pharisee thing. And then what proof does Nicodemus see that Jesus is from God?
He mentions the signs.
Signs. Yeah, which is interesting because signs and Pharisees are mentioned a few times in the New Testament. Can you remember maybe one of the others? You don't have to have the reference, but what's kind of the general idea?
I think about 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It doesn't specifically mention Pharisees, but it does say Jews demand a sign, Greeks wisdom, but we preach Christ and him crucified.
Yeah, which relates to the times where signs and Pharisees show up with Jesus, because oftentimes they're asking Jesus for a sign to prove he is who he says he is.
Yeah, that's right.
But what does Nicodemus see already and recognize?
He sees the signs already and believes only God could do these things.
Yeah. So again, I'm kind of making an interpretive move here, but it sounds to me like Nicodemus is at least open to the possibility that Jesus really is from God, really has something to say, and is worth listening to.
Yeah.
And that's surprising because he's a what?
Pharisee.
A Pharisee. A Pharisee. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder how much it was like word on the street, like, you know, just in that community, mm-hmm. like, hey, this is happening. These people are getting healed or something is going on. Yeah. And he's exploring and maybe observing from a distance, mm-hmm. but he's hearing these reports. So I think it's pretty significant that he would go straight to Jesus. And I love that Jesus would give him the time of day knowing his heart, mm-hmm. like knowing Nicodemus's heart, that Jesus would be able to see, like, this is a significant conversation.
Yeah. How does Jesus respond to Nicodemus's statement about him being rabbi?
It's kind of like abrupt. It would seem like, you know, Nicodemus kind of gives him some love, like, you know, some honor. And he says, to see the kingdom of God, one has to be born from above. It's like, boom, let's get right to it, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And when a Pharisee hears the term kingdom of God, what might they be thinking about?
Probably this new world where everything's ordered.
Yep.
And
mm-hmm.
they also had a lot of misconceptions in terms of an earthly kingdom.
Yeah, it was an earthly kingdom, but it echoed an eternal kingdom of mm-hmm. God that would be this new world. The dead are resurrected, mm-hmm. which is one of the differing views between Pharisees and mm-hmm. Sadducees in particular, at least somewhat. The righteous will be vindicated. Mm-hmm. We talked about that. So those who are following Torah faithfully will be looked at by God and said, well done, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then also kingdom language, what was one of the pressures that they're experiencing politically? What kind of kingdom are they under?
Roman kingdom.
Roman foreign kingdom.
Right.
And so anytime the word kingdom of God comes mm-hmm. up, how might they hear that differently?
The kingdom of God to them would not have been a merely spiritual, otherworldly environment. It would have been because the Jewish promise of kingdom came with land as well as mm-hmm. the mm-hmm. manifest presence of God's rule in some specific way. So it would have been all inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Let's move on to the next phrase. One has to be born from above.
That's a little weird.
It's a weird words. Now, we have a lot of like evangelicalness that we carry with us. So the idea of born again, we're mm-hmm. like, oh yeah, I know what that means. But just throw that in the past for a second and just hear the phrase.
I know. Yeah. I love Nicodemus' response of, am I supposed to get back at my mom and come out again? I mean, I just love that.
Yep. And it kind of ties into the modern debate at the time, which was, to be Jewish, were you born into it?
Mm.
Or is it something you put on? And so if you weren't born Jewish, you could become a Jew by living a certain way? Or was it a mixture of both? And so I wonder if Nicodemus is maybe wondering, oh, is Jesus more of the Sadducee Essene, where you need to be born into Judaism?
And I think that born again phrase, which, like you said, is very much associated and identified with evangelicalism. I think it's kind of meant the same thing in our culture in terms of like a certain moving away from a certain cultural Christianity, mm-hmm. which is more identified with, oh, my mom and my dad or my grandparents went to church. Mm-hmm. And so I do mm-hmm. versus like, what does it mean to really follow God? Like, you know, yourself. So I think those same impulses of trying to get mm-hmm. to a sense of an authentic connection with God is being lived out here. Is it this?
Yeah, it's not piggybacking on somebody else's faith.
Yeah. If you think about, you know, how much the Pharisees loved the Torah mm-hmm. and its oral tradition, so they probably had huge chunks of it memorized, mm-hmm. that hope of the kingdom, I think about after deciding to really follow God, I had this deep hunger for God's word. Mm-hmm. And so everything was framed then by God's word. And so I think with Nicodemus here, having the Torah so part of his mindset that mm-hmm. there's just this hunger, like, how does this actually happen? And Jesus answering, you know, you have to be born from above. It's like, this is a completely different concept.
Yeah. And so Nicodemus asks a great question. And then Jesus responds with, I tried to put this in my own words. Nicodemus, it works like this. Be born of the Holy Spirit and water, which is kind of like watching the wind. That's real clear. thanks, Jesus. Right? Like, so Nicodemus responds, how can this be? Mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And I think if we think about Nicodemus and where he is in the story, John chapter 3, early on in the story, who else has the question of how does all this work?
Everybody
else.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the disciples don't understand how things work yet.
Yeah.
Jesus' family is going to show up confused many times.
Mm-hmm.
John
mm-hmm.
the Baptizer, mm-hmm. who proclaims who Jesus is, later is going to be like, I don't know about
this.
Are you really the guy?
Yeah.
So right now, Nicodemus is in line with everybody else in the story. But he's seeking. He's asking good questions. He's mm-hmm. open to hearing from Jesus, which is very pharisaical and rabbinical, to ask good questions and not just keep saying what you think, but mm-hmm. asking questions and listening.
I think about, again, going back to 1 Corinthians 1, verse 20, it says, where's the wise person? Mm-hmm. Where's the teacher of the law? Where's the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? Mm-hmm. So he's like, both the Greeks try to figure it out through their philosophy. Jewish leaders try to figure out through their looking at signs or the law. Nobody could get this right. And so they ended up crucifying the Son of God because his wisdom is supernatural from above, completely holistically different than all of us. And I think in that way, we can see similarity between us and the Pharisees and not so much difference.
So not everyone sees it this way, but when I look at Nicodemus, I see a very positive character in the New Testament. We're going to explore where he shows up more in the next conversation, but he represents the journey that all of us go on, which is asking Jesus questions, even if we didn't get to ask him in person like Nicodemus did, not fully grasping who Jesus is or what he's doing, but still following in faith the best he could and the best we can. And again, what is he?
Pharisee.
A Pharisee. So again, the stereotype sometimes can be helpful, but in this case, the stereotype of Pharisees being a certain kind of people is wrong because Nicodemus shows a very openness to who Jesus is and is a positive character in the story. And we'll see that even more in the next conversation. So before we move on to where Nicodemus shows up next in the story, there was one idea left hanging that I wanted to make sure we got to. And that was Jesus responds to Nicodemus when he's like, how can these things be? And he offers Nicodemus two kind of symbols. One's a symbol and one's more of a theological idea in answering Nicodemus. What's the symbol?
Moses and the serpent. Mm-hmm. I love that because I think that that's such a great way to describe what faith really is, because the Israelites, when they were being bitten by the poisonous snakes, if they looked to Moses, they were going to be saved from the poisonous snakes.
And Jesus says that just like Moses lifted up that snake in the wilderness, so the Son of Man will be lifted up. And which at this point in the story, we'll find out it's the cross. But at this point in the story,
we don't know
what that is yet.
Yeah.
Right. But again, he's speaking language that Nicodemus would be like, okay, I get that story. Mm-hmm. I know that story. But then notice how verse 15 ends.
That everyone who believes may have eternal life.
Yeah. Now that's interesting because of our three groups, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes, what's the group that believed in eternal life?
It's the Pharisees. Yeah.
So when does Nicodemus show up in the story again?
We see him in John chapter 7.
Yeah. So would somebody read verses 50 through 51, and then we'll talk about what the context is.
I'll read it. Yeah. Nicodemus, who had gone to Jesus before and who was one of them, asked, "Our law does not judge people without first giving them a hearing to find out what they are doing, does it?"
All right. So what's the context going on here?
It's kind of a funny situation in John 7, I think, because memory serves, the Pharisees send temple guards to arrest Jesus, and then they are so amazed by what Jesus teaches that they come back empty-handed. And like, man, that was amazing. And like totally neglected to do this. And so they get rebuked and they're like, we got to get this guy. We have to arrest him. And so it's in the context of essentially punishing Jesus that Nicodemus now poses a question, which again, in the rabbinic school, it's really trying to teach a point about the illegality of what they're trying to do in apprehending Jesus in the first place.
Mm. Yep. And so in essence, Nicodemus does what?
He's defending him.
He defends Jesus,
which
is really interesting. So in this context, we have some believe that Jesus is the Messiah, some don't. Pretty much the whole story of the Gospels, right? Some believe, some don't. Some don't know for sure. Jesus isn't helping matters at all because everything he seems to say increases the tension and doesn't decrease the tension. Now, we talked about in an earlier conversation what the kind of cultural climate was like. Was it a settled time, a stable time, or not?
No.
Chaotic.
Yeah. No, and there were a lot of revolts. In fact, most of the revolts start in Galilee with some kind of Galilean What's Jesus?
Galilean.
Galilean from Galilee. And so it's the hotbed of revolts. And so in a way, the Jewish leaders are probably feeling some pressure here, like, revolts don't go well for us. This is starting to get real hot in this setting. And so maybe that's one of the pieces that they're feeling. And then it says that the Pharisees wanted to arrest Jesus. Now, did all the Pharisees want to arrest Jesus?
Not everybody.
No.
And, you know, Daniel, you said that Nicodemus defended Jesus. And so many people did not defend Jesus. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Peter, you know, was denying him. And, you know, Nicodemus takes up and defends him.
And just in case we feel like that's still hazy, because technically all Nicodemus says is, does our law judge people without first giving them a hearing? Mm. Well, what is their response to him?
Verse 52, are you from Galilee too? Look at you, and you
part
will
of
find
it.
That a prophet does not come out of Galilee. So like it's pushing all the way back. Like, okay, you're trying to defend him.
Yeah.
And that means you probably
are lying.
So no, we're not doing this.
Yep.
And of course, earlier in verse 40, we see the debate, you know, he's the Messiah, he's a prophet, you know, like, so there's really split opinion about Jesus in this moment.
Yeah. So if we have any doubt that he's defending Jesus, the way they respond to Nicodemus when he brings up the question, it feels a lot more clear.
Yeah. Yes.
That they see Nicodemus as defending him. Oh, are you part of this revolt from Galilee too?
It's almost like, are you his brother? Yeah.
Yeah, right. So again, I think this gives us a little more evidence. Maybe Nicodemus isn't 100% on board with Jesus or fully understands who Jesus is yet, but he's at least sympathetic to Jesus. And he's the only named what in the story?
Pharisee.
So the only named Pharisee in the story defends Jesus. That is interesting.
Yeah. It's curious to me when I picture it now that Nicodemus had a one-on-one conversation with Jesus. And so in the same way that Nicodemus could have put Jesus into a category of revolters or whoever, he had the wherewithal to take the time to have a conversation and to sense if Jesus was the real deal. So I think that this is where, going back to the stereotype idea, that Nicodemus could have made decisions about Jesus apart from really knowing him.
That's good.
And then Nicodemus shows up one more time in the story. And when is that?
It's at the burial of Jesus. This is way back in John 19.
Look at verse 39.
Oh, yes.
Read that one.
Okay. Yeah. Joseph of Arimathea asked Pilate for Jesus' body. And then in verse 39, he was accompanied by Nicodemus, the man who had earlier visited Jesus at night. And Nicodemus brought a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds, and taking Jesus' body, the two of them wrapped it with spices and strips of linen.
Yeah. Now, Joseph of Arimathea is kind of an interesting little throw in here. We don't know for sure he's a Pharisee, but we see he's a part of the council. And what else does it say about Joseph of Arimathea?
He's a disciple of Jesus.
What kind of disciple?
Secretly.
A secret disciple or a hidden disciple of Jesus, which is really interesting. So you have Nicodemus aligning himself, first of all, with someone who's been seen as a revolter, right? Rome has Jesus killed and puts on the plaque, King of the Jews. They're trying to make a very clear statement that this is what happens when you try to revolt against Rome. Nicodemus aligns himself with a hidden disciple of Jesus. And takes the risk of being the one to prep Jesus' body. He follows the burial custom of the Jews. Now, again, he's prepping Jesus' body for burial, and the way it's being described is a long-term burial. So does he fully get where Jesus is? Maybe not, but then again, were the disciples surprised or not surprised when Jesus rose from the dead?
Done.
Right?
Yes.
So Nicodemus is right in line with the disciples with this other secret disciple of Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea.
Well, I'm going back again to the compassion. And I'm going back again to his heart for truth and recognizing it. And I'm sure there's stuff we don't understand because it isn't in the scriptures. But I'm blown away by the intimacy of this action. It's very, very special.
I'm still thinking about the encounter that Jesus has with Nicodemus. in John 3, where one, we see the fact that there is an exchange of discussion happening. And even the question when Nicodemus says, well, how can this be? How can someone mm-hmm. be born again? Mm-hmm. And he says, you're the teacher of Israel. You don't understand these things. I think I've always read that in a pretty like harsh, rebukey kind of way. But as you were explaining the broader context at this point that everybody's trying to figure this mm-hmm. out, mm-hmm. I think he's surfacing a tension that exists, that you can be in the system, you can be learned in the theology and still miss the unique spiritual dynamic of what God is doing through yeah. Christ. And so the tension between trying to follow very fastidiously and you know, the law
yep.
or just being obedient, right? And trying to not sin, but then also following the Spirit, that is still something we have to journey through and challenge today. Mm. And in that way, I do think that there's a lot of similarities between yeah. us and mm. the things mm-hmm. that the Pharisees are thinking about
right.
more than there is difference.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because when I see the development in Nicodemus, as we looked at the whole story of where he shows up mm-hmm. throughout the story, mm. I see someone all of us can relate to. And I kind of ended our last conversation with this. And I think it's important just to revisit these because it's for us too. He represents the journey all of us go on.
Mm-hmm.
We ask questions, we seek understanding, and we almost always fall short of understanding, right? We don't grasp who Jesus is or what he's up to, but we still try to follow him the best we can. And mm-hmm. I think we see that in Nicodemus, who was what?
A Pharisee.
Mm-hmm. And so as we talked about with stereotypes, they are sometimes helpful, but they're always wrong.
Mm.
And with Nicodemus, we see a stereotype in the Pharisees that's wrong because he really did seek out Jesus and perhaps found him. Mm. And we don't know for sure, but it sure looks that way to me.
Yeah, we don't know for sure. That part of Nicodemus's story is not given to us. But he certainly seemed to be on a trajectory that pointed him toward believing and following. And he didn't fit the militantly anti-Jesus stereotype we've laid on the Pharisees for sure. But in a lot of ways, we can find encouragement for our stories from this Pharisee, maybe trying to follow Jesus, even though there may have been some doubts and questions and serious obstacles. I found that helpful that Daniel noted he was right where everyone else was at this point in the story. And to keep asking questions and seeking answers, it's not necessarily a weakness, but can actually be stepping in the direction of faith. Well, that was a Pharisee named Nicodemus. And in part two of this study, we've got some more names for you. Some you'll recognize, others you may not. But I think we'll see that the Pharisee-like things they did took them in a direction very different from the stereotypical way that we may expect of a Pharisee. Don't miss that next part of the study called The Pharisees. Discover the Word is a small group Bible study from Our Daily Bread Ministries in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in which we invite you to walk with us through topics and passages that inform the way we read the Scriptures, challenge us as we live our lives as followers of Christ, and always point us to discover Jesus in the pages of the Bible. And as we wrap up part one of this study here on Discover the Word, I want to take just a moment to remind you that Discover the Word is just one of the Bible engagement efforts of Our Daily Bread Ministries. And our mission is to make the life-changing story and wisdom of the Bible understandable and accessible to people all around the world. We're based in the U.S., but we have offices in 35 countries and serve people in over 150 different countries. And we are a listener, reader, user-supported ministry. And so if you'd like to partner with us financially in telling the story of Jesus around the world, go to our discovertheword.org website and click on the Donate button and explore how you can do that. discovertheword.org. Click Donate. Thank you. Well, thanks for listening. I'm Brian Hedinga. Discover the Word is provided by Our Daily Bread Ministries.